You've been listening to the BBC News here on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Alan Stoller, and it's time for Soundings. We're going to go right into it. I'll thank our underwriters a little bit later, but I want to get right into this program. Imagine you're working on a stovetop, and some of the burners are on, some of them are off, some of them are on high, some of them are just on low, and again, some of them are off. You put various pots of water on the stove. Some of them are half on the burners, half off, some of them directly on, some of them getting heated real hot, some of them not heated at all. Some of them start boiling, some of them just get warm, steam's rising up. You've got a big pitcher of ice water on a shelf above the stove, and the water that's boiling out of some of the pots is condensing on that ice water. You've got a countertop next to the stove where you could put food to cool, but you also have a heat lamp on one part of the countertop, and that keeps things warm. Heating things from above, you're heating things from below, you're heating things from the side. You've got tubes, let's say, that will allow the steam to go from one pot into another pot or into another area. You've got tubes that allow warm air to go to where the cold air to go where the warm air was. You've got warm, moist air, cold, dry air, maybe warm, dry air, and cold, moist air, whatever. You can move these fluids from one place to another. Now take this experimental surface that we're working on and mold it around a sphere, make it round all around this ball, and then make that sphere really, really large. What we've got here is the Earth. Lots and lots of fluids moving around the various continents, and there's nothing really holding them there permanently. Things can move. Things live in these fluids. We live in this ocean of air. Lots of things live in the oceans, and we all depend on Goldilocks solutions. In other words, not too hot, not too cold, not too bright, not too dim, not too wet, not too dry. Real important to have things just the way you want them. Siberia and Alaska almost touch. That gap between Siberia and Alaska is the Bering Strait. If you go south, you come to that arc of islands coming off Alaska, the Aleutian Island arc. And if you go north from the Aleutian Islands up to the Bering Strait, you're in the Bering Sea. With us on the phone right now is a group of scientists who are aboard the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Healy. The Healy is the newest icebreaker in the American fleet. Dr. Lee Cooper has been working in the Bering Sea, the North Bering Sea, for some time. Hello, Lee.
Yeah, hello, Alan. How are you?
Very good, thanks. And your signal's coming in very well. You've looked at the physical oceanography, what makes up the Bering Sea, and perhaps you could describe it a little bit. What are the physical conditions that the critters and the plants have to deal with in that sea?
Well, I think the important thing for your listeners to know is that the Bering Sea is relatively shallow. Most of it is. There's a deep portion that's a branch of the North Pacific, but the shallow portion that we're in, it's only about 50 meters deep, the water we're in now, so less than 200 feet, and it's shallow, it's very productive. We're seeing a huge phytoplankton bloom right now, and all that material is settling to the bottom, and it feeds a very rich, what we call benthos. They're all the animals that are living in the sediments, and there are animals that depend on those animals living in the sediments, and there are things that people think of with the Arctic, and they're walruses and bearded seals and gray whales that swim by California earlier this winter, and they're starting to arrive here now and feeding on the bottom. And so that's the situation. That's the ecosystem as it's set up in the Northern Bering Sea at this time.
Now, when paleoecologists are looking at seafloor sediments, they take cores, and they can see that, well, things were pretty much the same year after year after year by what was falling down to the bottom of the sea. The critters, as they die, fall down to the bottom. The sediments coming in from rivers or by currents of the ocean are falling to the bottom and collecting, and that's what they're looking at in these cores. And then they can see all of a sudden something changes, that the critters are different, or the sediments are different, or they're looking at isotopes, the types of atoms that are there, and they can see that the temperature has changed. And that seems to be what's happening in the Bering Sea right now. And perhaps one of you could speak to us about that.
Yeah, maybe I'll put Jackie Grebmeier on, and she can talk a little bit about what the patterns of sea ice retreat have been. Jackie, you want to address that?
Sure. One of the things that's characteristic of this region is the ice cover that comes down in the wintertime, often down to what is called the Pribilof Islands. But in the recent years, the extent and the thickness is quite variable. And in fact, the last 5 years, the highest retreat of the sea ice occurs in this region of what we call the Western Arctic between Russia and the U.S. And so this changes how you form how you form saline water that moves northward into the Arctic Ocean. And so we've seen this retreat of sea ice earlier in the season, and that influences the biology of the system, the timing of when the production occurs, when the zooplankton, the small critters in the water column are consuming or there or not. So if they're not there at the right time, then a lot of material goes down to the sediments, or if they are there with warming waters, or they're growing faster, they consume that. And that changes what we have up here right now. In the past, they have a benthic system dominated by creatures in the sediments, a lot of bottom-feeding bigger animals like gray whales, bearded seals, diving sea ducks. And the southern Bering Sea, where the fisheries are, and a lot of the higher zooplankton population. So there's a change, what we call the front, between the subarctic and the Arctic, and we're starting to see a movement northward and a warming of those waters moving northward that has a large impact on the ecology of the system.
In other words, part of what had been considered Arctic might now be considered subarctic. Not quite as cold.
Yeah, that seems to be the indications are that that's happening, and there's this cold pool system that is formed over the winter, and because it stays cold through the summer, it keeps out some of the predators, such as bottom-feeding fish or crabs or various organisms that are more common in the southern Bering Sea that would then compete with the bottom organisms for carbon sources. So we're starting to see this warming trend changing the movement of populations northward, be it from possible fisheries and small to invertebrates, to actually further migration of mammals northward, like the gray whale.
Now, something we're looking at here in California is migration upwards in mountains. What you're looking at is migration northward. There's only a limit as to how far critters can move upward in a mountain before they reach the top of the mountain, and there's nothing but air. Is there a limit as far as how far the whales and the walruses can migrate north?
This is Lee Cooper again. Jackie actually was part of a paper that showed that the gray whales, instead of feeding actually right in the area we are now west of Nome, that they're predominantly moving north into the Chukchi Sea, north of Bering Strait. And one of the other issues is what happens to animals that are dependent upon shallow water, because if they're dependent upon sea ice, for instance, walruses sit on sea ice and then dive into the water, and they can't dive that deep. Once you get to the end of the continental shelf in north of Alaska, the water's too deep. There's no food down there anyway. And so if they really are dependent upon sea ice as a resting platform, they may be out of luck soon, because all of that sea ice is now retreating over only deep water in the Arctic Ocean. And the current projections are that by sometime this century, the Arctic Ocean could very well be ice-free during the summer.
And there's nowhere else for them to go.
Yeah, that's true. We do have a marine mammal specialist here, Gay Sheffield of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, who's on board the ship. And I don't know, Gay, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, hi, Alan. I'd just like to add that some of these animals are able to haul out on land, such as walruses. So there will be changes if this sort of scenario unfolds. There's going to be changes, but some of the animals will be able to adapt as best they can. They have options.
Okay, that's certainly good to hear. Could we speak perhaps with Dr. Jim Laverne, who is with the University of Wyoming. I want to reintroduce my guests here. We're speaking with Dr. Lee Cooper and Dr. Jackie Grebmeyer, both of the University of Tennessee. We just heard from Dr. Gay Sheffield, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And if Dr. Jim Levorn is there, University of Wyoming, what about the seabirds? Where do they go? These are also critters that are dependent on the benthic organisms, in other words, the organisms that live in the mud at the bottom of the sea. And it's not very deep, of course. We're still on the continental shelf, so maybe a couple hundred feet down. But what happens to the birds that dive for these critters?
Okay, well, the fact that these birds are diving in 40 to 70 meters of water means that they have to have fairly high intake rates when they get to the bottom, and we've measured these intake rates at different densities and depths in the sediment in captive birds as a means of determining where in this region the birds can break even, what we call energetically. In other words, the cost of diving can't exceed the cost of the amount of energy that they take in at the bottom. And there are a lot of things that affect that, but certainly prey density is one of them, and the types of prey. And in trying to determine what areas need to be protected in perpetuity from effects of trawling or other industrial impacts on those areas, we need to get a better idea of exactly where are the areas where they can feed profitably. And so we've worked a lot in determining diets and worked with captive birds to try to develop ways of estimating that. And in working with Jackie, we've got some long-term data on the dispersion of those foods over a fairly large area. And one of the things that may alter predictions of where those closed areas might need to be is global change or climate change in this region, which can allow changes in recruitment of the prey animals that are there, changes in the influx of predators that actually compete with the birds, such as crabs and fish, and maybe even snails and sea stars. And so we're trying to develop ways of estimating a little bit more quantitatively, you know, what the extent of the areas are that need to be protected. Because as climate changes and some of these important other predators come in, which are also commercially fish species, there will have to be decisions made about where we will allow trawling and other types of disturbance to the bottom, and where we can't because the birds are actually dependent on them. And hopefully by getting a little ahead of the game, we'll be able to head off some of the very severe political conflicts, such as they've had with Stellar sea lions and the pollock fishery farther south. But we're working in a benthic system and trying to determine what are the factors that would alter those things.
One more fight to look forward to. I wonder, do you see any trends in the populations of seabirds? Are they having to move north or out of the area?
Well, again, in terms of sea ducks that are generally benthic feeders, most of the sea ducks in the western Arctic are down by anywhere from 40 to 70%. In Alaskan and western Canadian breeding areas, Stellar's eiders and spectacled eiders are now classified as threatened. King eiders and common eiders, the western Arctic populations are down by about 50%. Old squaws, or long-tailed ducks as they're usually called now, are down by about 70%. And these birds breed in different areas, often in tundra, but often in interior areas. They winter in different areas. And the fact that it's such a widespread decline over such a big area and so many species indicates that something as big as global change is probably responsible, although we really haven't nailed down any of those effects per se. And in this study, we are looking specifically, because Jackie has a long-term data set on food availability in the winter, we're really trying to test the idea of how limited these birds are in the winter and how that may be affecting their population status. But those are difficult questions to get at, and will take a number of years to answer.
Another question for Jackie. Here in California, for instance, we have alien species invading, for instance, San Francisco Bay. And part of the problem is that they're replacing some of the little critters, the zooplankton, tiny little things that are swimming around in the bay, that had been food for fish. And they've got different moves. In other words, these things always try to escape being eaten by the fish, and they can zig and zag. And some of these invading species zig and zag better, or at least differently, than the species the fish are used to, and some of the fish are really going hungry. Are you seeing a change down at that level, the zooplankton or even the phytoplankton, the plants, the tiny single-celled plants that these zooplankton are eating themselves?
I don't think, well, in San Francisco Bay, there has been, one of the main things has invaded, this is Jim Lovern again, this invaded is the clam Potamocorbula amurensis, and actually have a project down there where we're looking at the effects of that change in the prey base on birds that are feeding there. We have very little idea of how it's affecting fish, except that these clams actually filter out all the spring bloom as well as many of the zooplankton, so that you don't have no longer have a spring bloom, and many of the zooplankton populations are depressed, both from food deprivation as well as being filtered out of the water by these clams. Up here, I don't think we have very good information on effects on zooplankton, and most of that work has been done down in the Southeast Bering Sea. What may affect it more is whether or not you have a spring bloom, or as intense and widespread a spring bloom, which may cause some food limitation to the zooplankton, or maybe even changes in the species composition.
Here in California, in the Southwest, we've got a desert, and when spring comes, after the late winter, early spring rains, the desert greens up. What you're looking at is a bloom of phytoplankton, actually, that in an area that had been covered with ice. What had been the limiting factor? Is it simply that the ice is preventing light from getting through, or are there other limiting factors that don't allow the bloom to happen until the spring?
Yeah, this is Lee Cooper. I'll see if I can address that. We do traditionally have an ice edge bloom that when the ice breaks up, there's plenty of sunlight up here. It's a very nice sunny day. I think we'll have temperatures in the 50s today. There's a little bit of broken ice around. It's very calm, and that sets up as that ice melts. There's a lot of fresh water in it, and it stabilizes the upper water column, and the plants are sitting up there. They're in the ice already because the ice gives them some structure, and the light gets through the ice, and we see marine algae growing on the bottom of the ice, and then so as that breaks up and begins to melt, that all that algae will end up in that upper stable water column and go into an incredible bloom. The numbers we see in terms of the amount of chlorophyll in the water right now are as high as you'd see anywhere in the world ocean. It's a fairly I mean, nothing happens here in the winter in terms of productivity, but for this period of spring and early summer, it's a tremendous bloom, and we are seeing sort of world-class chlorophyll concentrations in the water at this time.
You can see that from space, too, when you look for the chlorophyll from a spacecraft in orbit. The Bering Sea, the whole coastal area there just lights up. It glows.
No, that's correct. This is Jackie Grandmeyer. I just want to add one thing related to the copepod versus invasive species versus just the normal effects of temperature. In the southern Bering Sea, where we tend to have warmer waters compared to the northern, that allows the zooplankton to reproduce and to move on to their life cycles, and they can start grazing or cropping the production, and therefore they limit the what is called the net export down to the animals that live in the sediments. Whereas in the northern, with the colder temperatures, the zooplankton are depressed, and you have more of that organic matter feeding the clams or the diving ducks or the walrus and so forth have. But with the warming trends that we're seeing, it basically, as I said, is moving that capability for the zooplankton to actually have a more rapid consumptive rate, and that changes from what we call a benthic system we have now to the potential of pelagic. And what does that mean? Well, you have more fisheries, and they're starting to see some salmon fish, salmon various types moving all the way into the Arctic, more so than before. We see some of the pollock, a smaller year class of pollock, going northward, and with that is associated the potential for human fisheries development. So there's resource exploitation that the potential is there not only from fisheries moving northward, but currently there's enhanced exploration for oil and gas right on the shelf system. So what you have is in the northern, you'd have more traditional hunt by local native populations into the marine resources, and more of the commercial fisheries in the south. You have, therefore, the potential conflict of everything moving northward and having those changes in a larger, with an ecosystem shift that may not go back to the way it was.
Speaking of oil and gas, what we're seeing here as this material falls down to the benthos, to the bottom of the sea, and collects there, if it's not eaten by the clams and all the other critters on the floor, then it can be covered by sediment and in a few million years become oil. Now, that's not going to matter a whole lot to us here since it's going to take some millions of years, but it does immediately sequester carbon out of the system, and that is a big part of the way that we do keep carbon dioxide from building up in the atmosphere. Can you make any judgment on that, on whether material is accumulating there and you have a net sink for carbon or not?
Well, some of the work we've done that was supported by the National Science Foundation, shelf basin interactions, has shown that there is a lot of carbon being sequestered on the continental slope. So when you get to the edge of the continental shelf, that there's material being transported to there, both in particulate and also some dissolved organic carbon is getting into the deep Arctic Ocean. And so over the time scale of in terms of things that are in the water, we're talking about timescales of thousands of years. And then, as you point out, if something does get sequestered in the sediments, it can be there for millions of years. I think in terms of the big picture, the Arctic is probably not a huge part of the whole world's global carbon cycle. In terms of the Arctic Ocean, there is a lot of organic carbon that is stored in Arctic peats. All of the rivers that flow into the Arctic Ocean, something greater than 50% of the organic carbon on Earth is stored in river basins that flow into the Arctic, and these are these great West Siberian peatlands. So there is a lot of stored organic carbon in the form of peat, particularly in Russia. And what happens is the permafrost thaws, and whether that will be released into river systems and end up in the Arctic Ocean and contributing to enhanced, there could be like what we'd call a positive feedback. As permafrost thaws, we could end up with more organic carbon in the system available for bacteria to metabolize, and we could see more CO2 in the atmosphere. So I think it's possible that we might go the other direction. Rather than having productivity drive organic carbon storage in marine sediments, with warming as it's going, we're more likely to see more carbon dioxide and, for that matter, methane released from peatlands on land in the Arctic.
Here in California, we're pretty familiar with the Aleutian Low, that low-pressure system that forms south of Alaska. And when the jet stream is just right in the winter, it'll send us a really cold, deep snowstorm. Those are those really cold storms we get in the winter from the Gulf of Alaska. Now, there's also a high-pressure system over Siberia, and these two pressure systems are always interacting. That the way they interact will affect the weather that we see, but especially the weather that you see and the climate that you're seeing. I'm wondering, and this will probably be the last question that we could talk about, is there any way to tell how much of this change, this ecosystem change you're seeing, is because of the world's climate rearranging itself? Does it look like it's part of a long-term trend? Are there any clues that you can give us towards that?
Lee Cooper again. One thing to keep in mind is there are oscillations that you pointed out, high pressure, low pressure. There's both a North Pacific decadal oscillation and there is an Arctic oscillation, and these shift over decadal time periods. So every 10 years or thereabouts, there are shifts. We have seen some shifts as recently as, say, 1999, 2000, in terms of the Arctic oscillation, and the changes that are there haven't necessarily, they're not playing out the same way that that people have thought traditionally, and we're seeing warming trends that seem out of counter or out of lockstep with what be expected by shifts in these decadal patterns. So despite the fact that there are shorter-term variations, the longer-term variation seems to be increasing warming of seawater temperatures and air temperatures. And so regardless of these atmospheric anomalies that we that are sort of in the same class as El Nino, we don't understand them that well yet, but people are continuing to work on these issues. There seems to be a longer-term trend towards warming of the climate, particularly in the Arctic, and that's why the National Science Foundation, their Office of Polar Programs, has invested a lot of money in research in the Arctic to try to ascertain what the issues are and separating shorter term from longer term climate analyses. Jim Laverne's also looked into or has studied a lot of this North Pacific decadal oscillation. Maybe if you've got a minute or two left, I'll put him on and he can tell you a little bit from his perspective.
Please.
Okay. Well. That you have a very good question, and it's one of the questions that has maybe prevented more action to cut back on the things that we believe may be responsible for climate change, the emissions from fossil fuel burning and that sort of thing, because it is very difficult to separate the noise in the system from a longer term signal. And that's the reason that, for example, work like Jackie's that has where she's been very persistent in returning to the same places over as many years as she's been able to, have been very important to our being able to understand what's going on. In the work that we're doing, for example, in trying to determine what areas need to be protected for as refuges or whatever you want to call them for the eiders or other species, it's very important to try to figure out how the dispersion and abundance of different prey items may change over time, because you might set up a refuge in one area and then find that with natural noise or with global change that those areas that are best may change. And so when you're trying to identify important areas for the upper, what we call the upper trophics, or the animals higher in the food web, it is very important to look at those longer-term changes. And in the Northern Bering Sea, we've had, or in the North Pacific in general, there was a major regime shift in 1976 toward warmer conditions. We think there might have been another one right around 1980 or 1990 that was probably less intense, but also with significance. And trying to always realize that there are these regime shifts, and that they have to be accounted for in looking for trends in global change is very important.
I want to thank you all for being with us today, Lee, Jackie, Gay, and Jim. Very good of you. I'll let you get back to work.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Dr. Lee Cooper of the University of Tennessee, Dr. Jackie Grebmeyer of the University of Tennessee, Dr. Jay Sheffield of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and Dr. Jim Laverne of the University of Wyoming. I'm Alan Stoller. This is Soundings on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking poison oak.
You find your phone been disconnected. You can't even make no call. You holler out for your baby. Oh, and she's not there. You look in the closet, buddy, and you find it's all there. Thank you.
With Albert King in the background, let me thank the Sierra Fund, now accepting reservations for a specially designed California license plate honoring the Sierra Nevada. Proceeds from this plate will support protection and restoration of rivers, forests, and mountains in the Sierra. For more information or to pre-register, visit www.sierralicenseplate.org. Thanks also to Sierra Solar Systems, serving the foothills and the environment for 26 years, offering financial analysis, site visits, and classes. Their solar-powered showroom and warehouse is at the Alternative Building Center. It's at the Alternative Building Center, 563 Idaho Maryland Road in Grass Valley. Their number is 530-273-6754, and you can get them on the web at www.sierrasolar.com. With me on the phone right now is Dr. Donald Crosby. He is professor emeritus at UC Davis and author of a book published by Oxford University Press called The Poisoned Weed. Hello, Don.
Hello.
So, poison oak. I was just riding into town today and I saw it along the road and it's blooming. It's pretty little quarter-inch white flowers are blooming and didn't notice any fragrance. I did lean as close as I dared and try to smell something. But poison oak is one of a large family of plants that have given a lot of people a lot of problems. So perhaps you could tell us, what is it related to?
Well, there's a, as you've mentioned, quite a number of plants that all produce skin lesions, that is, dermatitis, when you get the juice on them. And included in that, besides poison oak and poison ivy, for example, mango, you know, a fruit that has caused dermatitis all over the world. And in fact, in Florida, the dermatitis around a person's mouth has been called the Florida grin because it it distorts your mouth. Cashew nuts, unless they are cooked well enough, have the same poison that poison oak has. Lacquer trees grow particularly in the Orient, and they're used to make the black lacquer Oriental bowls.
And that's interesting because when you pick, I'm one of the lucky people who's not very sensitive to poison oak, so I can get away with picking a leaf or breaking a stem. And then you, say, write something on a piece of paper. A little while later, you'll see what you wrote in black.
Uh-huh.
That resin turns black. So is that the same resin that they use for lacquer?
Yes. And it, that resin, the lacquer, has received very, very extensive use, a lot of different things. And to me, the one that conjures up particular pictures was painting toilet seats with the poison oak lacquer. Desert bluebells, another plant that has very similar poisons. These little blue flowering plants that right now are out blooming in the spring.
Getting back to the toilet seats, you mentioned in your book that there have been problems when the lacquer was not properly cured.
Yes, that is when you have the problem. I have a Japanese lacquered bowl, quite an old one, and I've never had any difficulty with it at all. It apparently was correctly cured, but the particularly as the market increases, the tourist markets, then one can expect that there's going to be a lot more dermatitis coming out of these lacquered bowls and other lacquered goods.
Now, when you see a plant putting out a substance like this that can cause such grief, we normally assume that it's evolved, it's been selected for because it has some advantage to the plant, and it would keep critters from eating it. And yet I've seen deer nibbling on poison oak perfectly happily.
Yes, it's hard to say why a plant produces a particular kind of chemical. In the case of poison oak, it might be as protection against insects, because insects, chewing insects, are susceptible to poisoning by poison oak. But there are a lot of other examples that it would be very hard to to rationalize. So often I think these substances are just their waste products, and the plant is not making them for any particular reason.
You mentioned a number of other poisonous plants that are not related to poison oak, and perhaps we can go into those just a little bit. For instance, poison nettle, which we do have around here.
Yes, right. Well, the nettle is a good example of something to stay away from. If you've ever gotten into a patch of nettles, then you know that these are very hard on your skin. The reaction is one of irritation, whereas poison oak is allergy.
Okay.
And of course, as the sufferer, that doesn't make a lot of difference to you which of those it is.
I should have called it stinging nettle instead of poison nettle, but the allergy is you're really involving the immune system. And
yes.
It's something where you get sensitized, and then you put out histamine, which is a reaction to damaged cells. And among other things, they make your blood vessels leaky, so you get inflamed, and you can take antihistamine to put it down.
Well, that's exactly right. And you can use antihistamines to a degree to help you with the poison oak symptoms, but generally there's not an awful lot that you can do other than just try to control the itch.
And how do you do that?
Well, hydrocortisone that you can buy over the counter is what I use. I find it particularly soothing, and Benadryl is another drug, over the counter pharmaceutical that you can use. Also, taking a very hot shower can help a lot, in that partly it just desensitizes your skin, and partly it'll wash off any of the sticky poison that still remains on the skin.
You've got a lot of chemical structural formulas in here. In other words, you can see pictures of what the molecule looks like. And it's always fun to look at molecules and just as one example, look at male and female sex hormones, and they're so, so similar, just but for a few atoms. And you can look at a lot of, literally dozens of these compounds here, and they're made by different plants. They have different degrees of allergenicity, or we are sensitive to them to different degrees. And yet, it's interesting how so many different plants have come up with very, very similar compounds. Now, they come from rather common precursors. In other words, the building blocks of these compounds are found in perhaps all plants, or at least very many plants. Can you tell if these irritants that we're talking about, such as urushiol, which is in poison oak, can you tell if this is something that evolved a long time ago and then was inherited by all these plants, or is it the other way around, that they all inherited the basic building blocks and then evolutionarily invented urushiol or similar compounds on their own?
Well, I think you already touched on that, the answer to that. It's that these come out of some basic biochemical pathways that are available to many or all plants. And different species have evolved ways of handling those chemicals, diverting them into wide variety of plant products, and it's to be expected that not all of those plant products are going to be good for humans. We operate on a different system.
No doubt about it. Where does the word urushiol come from?
That's a Japanese word that refers to the particular plants as they grow in Japan, and those are the lacquer trees that I mentioned. There's a story of people in London cutting down some trees in order to make room for a pavement expansion, and the wood was cut up and made ready for firewood, and fortunately somebody recognized that those trees were lacquer trees that had been imported decades before, and fortunately they were not burned. because that is a really difficult thing to handle, burning these allergenic plants, because that is a fairly frequent way in which people get exposed. Say to poison oak, burning trash slash that contain poison oak branches. So there's a variety of ways that humans can be exposed.
I'm speaking with Dr. Donald Crosby, professor emeritus at UC Davis and author of The Poisoned Weed, published by Oxford University Press. Perhaps you could describe, given the fact that urushiol, the toxic ingredient in poison oak sap, is oil-soluble. That really is sort of key to how quickly it gets into us, and perhaps you could describe how it does get into the skin and under the skin.
Yes, the skin is covered with a very thin, waxy layer. Maybe you've noticed that you drop a few drops of water on your skin. It doesn't soak right in. It sits there, little droplets, because you have this sebum that coats the skin. Well, many of these skin poisons, like the urushiol, are very fat soluble. So when you get a little bit of the urushiol or poison oak juice on your skin, then the poison is just absorbed rapidly. And I've seen the figure of that most of the poison from poison oak will be absorbed within 10 minutes. And that is due to this phenomenon of fat solubility. Then once the poison oak poison is absorbed into the top layer of the skin, it undergoes a chemical reaction, oxidation with oxygen, which converts it to the actual poison. The urushiol itself, I guess one could consider, was just a pre-poison. And the actual poison has to be made in your skin.
So, and how do we go about doing that?
Well, it's considered to be a process guided by enzymes, and the urushiol is oxidized to form a kind of chemical called a quinone. The quinone then can react with a protein, and in order to move the chemicals around in your body, it's necessary that they be attached to protein, and that's the way that the allergen gets attached, is by that chemical reaction. And then once in your body, and it goes through a series of steps, finally circulates in your bloodstream and gets to the point, back to the point where it entered. then you mentioned the disruption of cells that leads to inflammation.
And since, as you pointed out, it only takes 10 minutes for the substance to get through the skin and below the first layer of skin, that means that unless you happen to be right at home or someplace where you've got soap and water, and soap will make oily substances dissolve in water, then, or at least mix with the water, unless you are, you know, within 10 minutes of soap and water, it sounds like there's not a whole lot you can do about it.
Well, actually, there's several things that you can do, and which I do when I've been exposed. First of all, is to put on a blocking agent, something on the skin that will prevent the poison from entering. And one of those that comes to mind, you can buy at the drugstore, is called Ivy Guard. You rub that on before you go out. If you think you're going to be exposed to poison oak, you rub it on beforehand, and then every couple of hours, you should wash it off and put on a new layer. And that's actually pretty effective.
What is it?
It's just clay.
Uh-huh.
It's bentonite clay that's suspended in a cream, and the clay takes up the poison and keeps it from entering the skin. So it should work on just about anybody. Then once you have been exposed, there is a lotion called Tecnu, T-E-C-N-U. And again, you buy that at a pharmacy. And it is like a soap, but it extracts the poison out of your skin. And that I've found that very, very satisfactory, very successful. Now, it doesn't necessarily get all the poison, so you can't guarantee that that you're not going to suffer from a rash, but it at least cuts way down on the discomfort. So I recommend those kinds of products.
Is Tecnu specific for poison oak, or does it just take all the fat out of your skin?
Yeah, it'll lift out anything that isn't tied down. And of course, most of your fat is not easily mobile, so this very fat soluble urushiol can be pulled out. And I don't know how long you have after you get exposed. I've been exposed to poison oak for a number of hours and still had that Tecnu be effective for me.
One last question. As you point out in your book, urushiol has a boiling point of something like 400 degrees centigrade, so I wouldn't expect it to be very volatile, and yet there seem to be people who can more or less just look at the plant and be affected by it. In other words, something seems to be coming off the plant. You have experience with that?
Yes, my wife is one of those people. She's very sensitive to poison oak, and I wasn't convinced about her picking up the poison from just the air until I actually observed it, and I know she didn't touch the poison oak plant, but she still came down the poison oak. Now the boiling point is just one indication that the chemical is vaporizing. The measure of the chemicals evaporating is called the vapor pressure, and the urushiol has a definite measurable vapor pressure, so it doesn't mean that it boils off fast like gasoline would or something, but it still can vaporize, and if you're very sensitive, you can still get poison oak.
Don, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Dr. Donald Crosby of UC Davis. He's the author of The Poison Weed, which is published by Oxford University Press. I'm Alan Stoller. This is KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'd like to thank the Sierra Fund, now accepting reservations for a specially designed California license plate honoring the Sierra. Proceeds from this plate will support protection and restoration of rivers, forests, and mountains in the Sierra. For more information or to pre-register, visit www.sierralicenseplate.org. Thanks also to Sierra Solar Systems, serving the foothills and the environment for 26 years, offering financial analysis, site visits, and classes. Their solar-powered showroom and warehouse is at the Alternative Building Center, 563 Idaho Maryland Road. That's in Grass Valley. Their number is 530-273-6754, and you can catch them on the web at www.sierrasolar.com. Coming up in just a few minutes, it's New Dimensions, and then from 2 to 4, Blues with Twos, So Many Roads. This is KVMR-FM, Nevada City. Talk to you again real soon.
mankind. Yeah, I don't know why you wanna treat me so bad, baby. You know I've been so sweet and kind. If you don't stop doing me the way you're doing me, baby, I'm gonna have to go to the crazy